says in Psalm chapter 22 and verse 6 that God is seated upon the praises of his people. And we've praised him, and I appreciate that. And I'm glad to be a part of building that throne. I wanted to mention two things. One is we do have a VBS meeting right after our dismissal prayer, or a few minutes after. I'll give you some time to talk a little bit. But over there in the annex, and I've on this side of it, just grab a chair and bring it on out there and set it up for yourself. And we'll have about a 15 or 20 meeting. This is to get our VBS kicked off and moving in the right direction. And I hope everyone knows who this is for. Surely you do. And the other thing is we've got a slot or two left for this public reading of Scripture down at the courthouse. That little list is hanging on the bulletin board back there on the south side of the foyer. And if you would be able to come and read for a half hour between 3 and 5 on Wednesday, that would be great. And so there's still some slots there that are open. And we can have more than one person for those half-hour slots if you want to share with somebody for that. Well, we're talking about Jesus this morning. And like I said just last week, I sense it was just kind of time for a change of pace, and I want to stay with this for a few more weeks. And then we'll get back to some of the stuff we've been working on in terms of the church and talking about that. But this morning we find Jesus upon the Sea of Galilee. And, our scripture reading this morning, Luke chapter 8, verses 22 through 25, that's the event that we're talking about. That time, early in Jesus' ministry, when he is crossing over the Sea of Galilee with his disciples and a big storm blows up. You can read this account, this story, in three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We've read it already from Luke chapter 8. I'm not going to read from Matthew chapter 8, 23 through 27, but I'm going to allude to a couple things there as we talk about this morning. But right now we're going to read from Mark chapter 4, 35 through 41. This is the account that I want to work with. And if you've got a Bible, if you will just open it up and hold it open to that place, you can look at the verses that I'm talking about. I'm reading out of the New American Standard. It's going to read a little different than what the version you've got in your hands probably. But Mark chapter 4, 35 through 41, that's where we want to look this morning. I'm starting at verse 35. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." One thing we need to understand as we read verse 35 is that this is at the end of a long day of teaching, which started all the way back in chapter 4 and verse 1. If you turn back, it says in chapter 4 and verse 1, he began to teach again by the sea. And such a very large crowd gathered to him that he got into a boat in the sea and sat down, and the whole crowd was by the sea on the land. And then you can kind of listen to what Jesus was saying to that crowd, but there were so many people, Jesus felt the need to get out away from the shore. There was a boat nearby, and I think he summoned that boat to come. He got in the boat, backed out a little ways. Jesus was then able to address this whole large crowd which was there. But he is, as it says right here, he is on the Sea of Galilee. And where he actually is very close to the city of Capernaum. And that would be like the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, if you can just get that in your mind. The northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, very close to the city of Capernaum. Jesus says, at the end of this day, he says, I want to go over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And why does he say that? Because he's just tired. He's been dealing with people all day long. There's been huge crowds of people pressing on him. And teaching and caring and speaking and dealing with people all day long, after a while, it just begins to wear you down. And so Jesus feels the need for some rest, and the only way he sees to get out of this is to just turn that boat around and head out. Then that's kind of what he's asking his disciples to do. But it says in verse 36 then, leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat just as he was, and other boats were with him. And so it says the disciples took him in the boat that he had been teaching in all day long, just as he was. And I've read those words, and I underlined them the last two or three times that I've gone through, just as he was. What's he talking about, just as he was? Well, they weren't going to take him in and try to get him over to Capernaum somewhere to take a shower or to get a fresh change of clothes or to get a meal. That wasn't going to work. It was just going to make this crowd thing even worse, and Jesus was going to be dealing with people every step of the way. And so rather than bring him into shore and take him to maybe Peter's mother-in-law's house, which was nearby. They just took him just like he was, dirty, stinky, hungry, and they just headed off to the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And this says in verse 37, "And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much that the boat was already filling up." And so as they make their way across to the east side of the Sea of Galilee from Capernaum, a big storm blows up. And this is not all that unusual for the Sea of Galilee. It's kind of notorious for having calm, placid waters for a short while, and then all of a sudden things just change drastically, and you're in the middle of the storm of your life. And that's kind of what happened here in verse 37. The boat is taking on water. It's pitching. It's rolling. There's spray blowing all over the people who are on that boat. The disciples begin to fight to keep this thing headed into the wind. They're bailing water. The sails are down. The oars have come out. These guys are afraid of losing their lives as they cross the Sea of Galilee. And then we come to verse 38, and I'm not going to read that for just a second, but I just want to say this. Before all this storm blows up, verse 38 tells us that Jesus had laid down in that boat to take a nap, and that makes sense, doesn't it? If you're just tired and exhausted, and I'm not going to understand why his disciples would be glad for him to do that. You don't have to row the boat, Jesus. You don't have to help us sail this thing over there. We can take care of that. And they let him go down in the stern of the boat, and he lays down on a cushion. That's what verse 38 tells us. And then all of a sudden, things change drastically. After Jesus falls asleep, the storm blows up. The disciples are fighting for their lives. And Jesus is still down in the stern of the ship, sleeping on this cushion. Now, you have to wonder, if this is a really bad storm, how in the world can a guy on a small boat like this, and it wasn't a huge boat, not by any means, how in the world can a man sleep on a cushion in the middle of a storm like that in a small boat? It's being blown around, water's coming in. And the disciples see Jesus laying on that cushion, soaking wet, and they can't believe that he's still down there. They don't understand this. In fact, I don't believe that they thought he was asleep. I thought that they thought he was just laying there on purpose, letting them struggle, fight for their lives up on the main deck of this boat or this ship, just letting them do all the work. And he's down there basically, I think in their minds, pretending to be asleep. And they bite their tongues until they can't hold themselves anymore. And finally, someone goes down in the hold of the ship. It says in verse 38, Jesus himself was in the stern asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" It doesn't say who said this, but I think I know. The 11, or among the 12, there was one guy who always spoke up. The 11 might be thinking the very same thing that the 12th one was thinking, but the 11 never made a peep. But there was one guy who always opened his mouth, and usually it was a disaster when he did. It's Peter. I'm talking about Peter. All 12 of them are thinking it, but Peter is the only one that has enough guts to actually go down and say, "Master, don't you care that we're dying, that we're perishing?" It's quite an accusation to make of the Master. But in verse 39, it reads like this, "And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Hush.'" That's what my version says. I like King James on this. "Peace. Peace, be still." Three words. And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. Verse 40. "And he said to them, 'Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?'" You see that? First of all, Jesus rebukes the wind and the sea and all of that. And then he turns around to his disciples and there's another rebuke for them. "Why are you still afraid?" Luke puts it like this, the words of Jesus in Luke's account, Luke 8:25, "Where is your faith?" And then we come to verse 41. "They became very much afraid and said to one another, 'Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" And so they're amazed at what's happened here. Amazed. It's interesting here as you read in Luke chapter 4. This is early in the ministry, early in Jesus' time with the disciples. And they're saying, "Who is this man that even the wind and the seas obey him?" A few months later, Jesus is out on the same sea. And another incident, just very much like this, comes up again. But this is the one where Jesus comes to them walking on the water. And when Jesus has calmed the sea and made everything, you know what they say then? Truly, this man, truly, he is the Son of God. Truly, this is the Son of God. Big change in attitude between Mark chapter 4 and John chapter 6, where Jesus is walking across, or Matthew chapter 14, where Jesus is walking across the water, isn't it? Who is this man that the wind and the seas obey him? Truly, this man is the Son of God. Something has happened between Mark chapter 4 and Matthew chapter 14. That's where I remember seeing that passage. I want to focus on Jesus in this incident because for lots of reasons, but one is Jesus is not as predictable as some of us might think. When you followed along after Jesus, you were always finding yourself seeing things that you did not expect, things that you thought you had him figured out, and all of a sudden it's just going in a totally different direction. And you have to understand, Jesus had some options available to him that we as human beings do not. And I think that's part of the reason why he was always such a surprise, why he was always headed off in a direction you couldn't have anticipated. But Jesus also thought about things different than his disciples did. He just had a different way of looking at things, and he saw needs that we just kind of slide over. And sometimes I think Jesus engineers some of these situations and then does something strange just to get our attention, just to get his disciples' attention. But it was exciting to follow Jesus around because you never knew what was coming next. And that's one of the reasons the disciples were all the time following him around. They said, what's coming next? They wanted to know. Didn't want to miss anything. And just about the time they think they had it figured out, he does something that just totally surprises them. And it's no coincidence that he does something very unexpected in this incident here also. At the very least, these disciples expected Jesus to get up off the cushion and help without having to be asked. As in, surely he understands we need help. Surely we don't have to go down there and ask him to take care of us in this situation. But no, he just keeps right on snoozing down there. And there's a couple things I want to say here about this. First of all, I've just made a little rule for myself, and I think this is something you need to make for yourself. When you see Jesus doing something unexpected, you need to pay very close attention to what's happening. You understand what I'm saying? When he does something, put yourself in the shoes of the disciples. When he does something that would be a total surprise or unexpected to those disciples, or even to you, you need to pay very close attention to what's happening here. Something big is going down. Something big is about to happen. Jesus has got a plan. Jesus has got something in mind when he starts to do things that you couldn't predict and never would have expected. That's just one of my little rules. And so when you see Jesus, like in John chapter 11, someone comes to Jesus in John chapter 11 and says, hey, your best friend Lazarus is sick, and we think he's going to die. And Jesus says, yep, got it. And then he stands around, waits around for two more days before he even starts back. And by the time he gets back, Lazarus is already dead. Let me tell you something. Those 2 days that Jesus waits, that's not what anybody expected. They expect Jesus to pick right up and go right on over and take care of that business. But he doesn't. And I'm saying when Jesus does something unexpected, we need to pay very close attention. Something big is going down. And when Jesus is in a house, in Mark chapter 2, he's in a house in Capernaum. And he's teaching. He's got this big crowd of people around him. All of a sudden, the roof opens up, and here comes this a paralytic being let down into the room where Jesus is by five of his friends, however many is up there on the roof. And everyone can see he's paralytic. Everyone can see the guy's got a problem. They let him down, and what everyone is expecting Jesus to say, be healed. You know what he says? Your sins are forgiven you. Whoa. This guy needs to be healed. Your sins are forgiven you. I'm telling you, when you see Jesus doing something unexpected, when you see Jesus laying on a cushion in the stern of a ship, soaking wet, pretending to be asleep, while his disciples are up on top of there fighting for their lives, you better pay attention. Something big is going down. Something big is happening. There's a second thing I want to tell you about this little story. Sometimes we imagine that we can know what Jesus would do. And so, you see those little bracelets that people wear sometimes, WWJD, what would Jesus do? I've mentioned this before. What would Jesus do? And we kind of think, we got it figured out. We know what Jesus would do. Not really. First of all, Jesus had options available to him that we don't have for ourselves. Secondly, he always just looked at things differently. And figuring out exactly what Jesus would do in any situation is pretty tough. There's a little book written called In His Steps. This is back in the 50s. A guy named Charles Sheldon, I think it was back in the 50s, wrote a little book called In His Steps. And that book is based on that question, what would Jesus do? And it's a wonderful book. It's a valid question. I'm not arguing with the question. I'm just saying the truth is we don't always know what Jesus would do. But there's a better question that we can ask ourselves. And this is a question I think we can get a pretty solid answer. What would Jesus be? I think you can usually figure that out. What would Jesus be? Well, he'd be honest. He'd be fair. He'd be just. He'd be loving. He'd be forgiving. You can count on that. That just never varies. But exactly what he's going to do, who knows? He may be all up to something we don't know about. But those are a couple things I want you to think about as we get into this story. First of all, the main thing I want to get across today is Jesus is one of those people that was full of surprises. And it's true in this incident that we're reading about here. There are some surprises here. There's five or six that I can think of. And I'm going to mention five of them here tonight. And, you know, as I was looking over this thing this morning, I said, you know, there was a sixth one I should have put in, but I'm just going to leave that alone. I'll talk about that another time. But there's five surprises in this story, and here's the first one. The first surprise for these disciples, and for us, for that matter, is Jesus led his disciples into trouble. Does that surprise you? Jesus led his disciples into trouble. Now, why are these disciples out here on the Sea of Galilee anyway? Well, they're out there because that's what Jesus told them to do. Back in verse 35, Jesus says, let's go over to the other side. Well, how do you interpret that? What does that mean? That means, I want to go over to the other side. You guys are going to go with me. Let's go. Jesus wanted to go over to the other side. And so they're out there in the middle of the Sea of Galilee in this storm because that's where Jesus wanted them to be. They were doing the will of the Lord, and now they're in deep, deep trouble. How do you like that? You do the will of God, and the next thing you know, you're fighting for your life. Well, it happens that way sometimes. A lot of us expect smooth sailing and level paths, calm water and gentle breezes to our back when we are in the will of God. And what a shock it is when we have Jesus, but we find ourselves in the middle of a storm. But being in trouble with Jesus means you're having trouble with a purpose. You're in a storm for a purpose when you're in trouble with Jesus. You're with him, but you're in trouble. It means there's a purpose there. And that's why James says in James 1, 2, 3, and 4, James says words like this. He says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into various trials or testings or temptations. For the trying of your faith works patience, and patience, when it's had its full work, will make you perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So James says, you know, when you're actually in one of these situations where you are being faithful to the Lord, and all of a sudden you find yourself in the middle of a storm, he says, be happy. Be happy. He said, man, there's something good coming here. There's something, a benefit for you some way or the other out of this trial or this temptation. And so the Lord does not protect us from every storm. Sometimes he lets us wander right into them blindly. Sometimes he even steers us into them. And why is that? When the storm is where our faith is tested, and things like patience and maturity will develop for us as disciples of Christ when we have weathered that storm. But I think there may be another purpose for this storm that the disciples are going through. I'm sure they all benefited from this storm individually. I'm sure that there was a little more patience, a little more wisdom, a little more understanding of who Jesus was. But I think Jesus had something in mind about the bonding of these 12 disciples. Up until this point, this is early in his ministry, the disciples have been along with Jesus everywhere, and they are all bonded to him. They're all focused on him, and that's good. But Jesus wanted something to start to happen between these 12 guys, these 12 men. He's just called them to be disciples. He's a part of the 12. In fact, that happens earlier on in this very same chapter, if I'm not mistaken, early on in chapter 4, or maybe it's back in chapter 3 of Mark, where that happens. He's called them to be disciples, his 12 disciples, and they're all bonded to him, but they're not so bonded to each other. And I think part of the reason Jesus led these guys out into this storm was to take them through an experience that was going to bond them. This storm, I think, was about strengthening the bond between the disciples. When people go through storms, trouble, testing, whatever you want to call it, hard times, difficulty, fighting for your life together, the bond between them will be strengthened and will grow. And I remember a canoe trip that I had when I was with the church up in Michigan. We kind of started this thing, I don't know, probably went to four or five, maybe six different canoe trips. Every summer we'd get a bunch of people together and we'd go up to the either the Rifle River or the Osaba River. And there was a camping place up there you could camp and a canoe livery not too far away. We'd all go up Friday and try to get in there around noon, 2 o'clock, something like that, get our tents all set up. And then about 4 o'clock we'd get over to the canoe livery and they had about a 10-mile trip that you could make. And we'd get in our, we'd pay for that trip and there's about 40 of us to go up. And they'd take us out 10 miles away, and we'd come down the creek. Well, on this particular canoe trip, the one that we all remember, the one that we're never going to forget, and the one that has bonded us together, you could go there to this day and just say, remember that canoe trip? And yeah, they're all going, yeah, we remember that. Because it just brought us together in a way that we couldn't believe. But Friday night, we come down the river, and it's uneventful, and the water's maybe a foot, 2 foot, 3 foot deep at the most everywhere in the river. We're having to drag our canoes over rocks and things like this because the water's way down. Then about 7 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock in the evening, we're back at the camp. We're grilling hamburgers, and the rain starts coming down, and I mean it was raining like cats and dogs from about 6 o'clock that night. We ate our hamburgers in the rain, soggy buns and all. Potato chips, you know, they didn't chip. They just kind of squished. But we ate our burgers and our chips and all that in the pouring down rain. Finally got in our tents, and it continued to rain until about 4 o'clock in the morning. And by the time we got up in the morning, a sleeping bag weighed about 40 or 50 pounds because it was soaked up with water. We were laying in pools of water in wet soap. I mean, that's just the way it was. And we got up in the morning, and it was still raining when we first got up. Finally, it quit. About 8:30, 9 o'clock, the rain finally quit. And we said, well, you know, we're already wet, and we've got nothing to lose here. Let's go on over to the canoe livery and get on our canoes. So we go over, all 40 of us, get in the bus, ride out 20 miles. This is a 20-mile trip. They figure maybe 4 or 5 hours ordinarily for us to get back to the canoe livery. So we get in our we get on the bus and go out, and we're noticing that the water's kind of high and it's moving kind of fast. There's been a lot of water that's fallen. We got there to where they put us in, and they shouldn't have done it. They shouldn't have let us got on the river. If their insurance carrier ever found out what they did, they wouldn't have let them done it. But we got on the river, and here's the water going by. I mean, it's all chocolate and mud, and it's moving along 10, 15. I don't know how fast the water's going. We get in those canoes. Serena and I are bringing up the rear. Our job is to make sure if anybody, you know, gets capsized or gets hung up in a tree or gets lost or has a problem, we're coming along behind. We're catching them all, putting them back in their boats and all this. We get in those water. We had some really good canoers at the very front. And to tell you how fast it was a 4 or 5 hour trip. They were back at the canoe livery in an hour and a half. Okay? We're talking about 15 miles an hour to do that. Serena and me, it took us all the full 5 hours. Because as we're riding along, every bend we came around, there was one of our kids. We had kids like 10, 11, 12 years old going down this river. They were hanging in a tree that fell over the creek, and they were hanging in a tree. The canoe was down there, pushed up against another tree. People out on the bank crying and screaming and everything. We'd go get their canoe, bring it back, put them back in. And so we're working our way down the river, and they actually had some people who were injured that day. None of our people were injured. But they actually had some people. There was a kid that almost drowned. If it hadn't been one of our guys standing next to him, it just kind of pulled him up out of the water like this, that kid would have drowned. They had people that broke their legs. They got hung up in a tree the wrong way and pushed them right on. But we talk about that trip even to this day. And I remember Ted Stevens. Ted used to be a part of this congregation, and he worked with our congregation for a while up there. But he came the year after, and he heard us talking about this trip, and he said, you know what was going on, don't you? You know why that trip was so important? I said, no. I mean, like we can't get over it. He says, it's a fact. He says, people do not build bonds by having fun, socializing, and eating together, and carrying on, playing around. He says, the deepest bonds that human beings can make are formed when they are going through a crisis, a tragedy, a suffering kind of thing together. He says that's where people make the deepest bonds. And he said that's what's going on with these guys, these veterans from the war. He says they never forget their buddies. He said the guys were in the foxholes with them, and they were, you know, dodging bullets and shooting some back and all of this. He said the reason they are so close is because that was a horrible experience, and they went through it together, and they suffered together. And then he said, and then everything made sense to me. We suffered together. We were scared out of our wits. We shouldn't have been out on the water. But we couldn't quit talking about it. And to this day, you go up there and say, hey, remember that canoe trip? Oh, yeah, I remember that. And then you're into about 2 or 3 hours of stories about things that happened on that canoe trip. Well, what Jesus, I think Jesus had something in mind. Jesus knows that stuff. And he has these disciples all connected to him, but they haven't started connecting with each other. And maybe one of the greatest things that Jesus did for his disciples, one of the great things he did for his disciples, was just to teach them how to become bonded together, to start to care about one another. And here is a great experience. They're in this boat and they're fighting for their lives. And I guarantee you, they never forgot it. And it became the foundation of the bond, which they eventually enjoyed. But Jesus laid on that cushion, soaking wet, waiting for the crisis to have its full effect. And the disciples are getting madder and more upset and scared and desperate. And they're like, we're in a life and death struggle here. And all they can say is, Jesus, don't you care? Of course he cares. In a few months, he would be laying down his life for every one of them on a cross. But today, on this day, he had a plan for them, a purpose for this storm. He was going to strengthen them individually, and he was going to bond them into a unit. That's the first surprise. Jesus led his disciples into trouble, but it was trouble with a purpose. Here's the second surprise for these disciples. When this thing, just as the storm ends, Jesus not only rebukes the storm, but he rebukes his disciples. And they just were not expecting that. I wouldn't have expected it. The disciples are obeying Jesus' will. They've run into this storm. They struggled and strained to survive. They're doing everything they could to keep that boat headed in the right direction. Jesus calms the storm. And then he turns around and says to him, where is your faith? And they said, Jesus, what do you mean, where's our faith? We're just glad to be alive. Aren't you glad we're alive? What are you doing? What do you mean, where is our faith? I think it surprised him. You know, sometimes we expect Jesus always to be all warm and fuzzy and cuddly. And you know what? There are sometimes that Jesus is pretty hard. He just kind of got up in people's faces and he addressed their need. And then you don't always need to be warm and fuzzy and cuddly. Sometimes you just need to be straight up and tell people how it is. And he said, where is your faith? And so this rebuke from Jesus was unexpected, but it came anyway. And it was a rebuke about their lack of faith. And so when the storm comes, where is our faith? Is it in ourselves, in our ability to deal with waves and wind and storms and all that? Is it in the boat that we built? Is it in the life preserver that we put on before we started? Is it in our vast knowledge and experience in dealing with these things? Where is our faith when our home is moldering in ashes? Or when a spouse leaves, or we found a pink slip in the slot of our mailbox at work? Or we have a son or daughter who goes to prison, or death comes, or we're sitting in an examination room waiting for the doctor to come in and tell us what the biopsy shows, and he comes in and says, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have lung cancer. You have another kind of cancer. Or you're sitting there beside your child in a hospital bed, hooked up to tubes and monitors and all this kind of thing, and you don't know if the child's going to make it or not, or if they're ever going to get over this thing, whatever it is. Where's our faith when pain just will not go away? Or when our money is gone and the electricity and the water is turned off? Where is our faith? Yes, we need a good shepherd to rescue us and to comfort us and to encourage us. And Jesus is that for us when we need it. But sooner or later, the good shepherd is going to ask us the question, where is your faith? He wants us to be people of faith. Here's the third surprise for these disciples. And that is that Jesus was offended by something other than disobedience. Some people think the thing that really gets Jesus riled up is disobedience. And if it's rebellion, I guarantee you Jesus is offended. I have no doubt about that, if it's rebellion. But Jesus is offended here in this incident, not by disobedience or anything that these guys said or did. Yeah, that wasn't just the only thing he was focusing on here. He was not offended by that they tried to save themselves or that they tried to use their own knowledge and experience. He wasn't offended by the fact they come down and woke him up or even that they accused him of not caring. Jesus, don't you care that we're perishing? That didn't get him mad. I don't think that was what it was about. You know what he was offended by? He was offended by the gut-wrenching fear that he saw on their faces and their lack of faith in him. That got him mad. That got him upset. Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1:7, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but a spirit of power and love and a sound mind." Fear does not come from God. Fear is antithetical to God. Fear is antithetical to faith. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but a spirit of power and love and a sound mind. The disciples did not know who was on board with them, or if they knew, they certainly didn't trust him. They had seen his miracles. They'd heard his teaching. They watched him forgive sins. They had seen all of these things happen. But for some reason or other, they did not know who he was, or they did not trust who he was. If they had, they would not have tried to fight this storm so long by themselves before they called him. And so Jesus surprised them, because he was offended not by disobedience. He's offended by just their lack of faith. Here's the fourth thing, the fourth surprise for the disciples. And that is that Jesus bent the laws of nature. Jesus can bend the laws of nature, but he does not bend people. That's an amazing thing that Jesus did. He got up off his cushion. He stood on the deck. He said three words, "Peace be still." I wish I could say three words. Stuff like that happened. But you know, the words that come out of my mouth, it's moist, hot air. There is no power behind those words. But when God speaks, it's not just moist, hot air. There is an infinite power behind it that makes things happen and changes things. And so when God speaks, stuff happens. And Jesus said, "Peace, be still." He who made the heavens and the earth can calm a storm on the Sea of Galilee. Jesus could bend the laws of nature anytime he wanted to. But mark this down, he will not bend people. There was something Jesus wanted on this day more than to calm the storms on that sea. What he wanted to do more than anything else was change the men who were in the boat with him. He wanted them to be better men. He wanted their faith to grow. He wanted them to be the people that that he had in mind for them. He wanted to change them, but he doesn't coerce them. It's always an invitation. It's always a call. It's always there's always a choice. He kind of tells them where he wants them to go, but he never bends them to that thing. He lets them make the decision. Jesus can bend the laws of nature, but he does not bend people. Just an amazing thing. Listen to how Jesus speaks to people. He says in Matthew 11:28, he says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden." You hear that? It's just an invitation. "Come to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. Follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men." And then in the very last words of the Bible, Revelation 22, it reads like this, "The Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. Let him who is thirsty come and drink. Whosoever will, let him drink of the water of life freely." He doesn't bend people. He's just always inviting us, calling us, telling us where he wants us to come. But he always lets us make that decision. I try to keep that in mind when I'm studying with people. And because, number one, I don't want to scare them off. But you don't put people in a corner and not give them a way out. If they're not ready, they're not ready. And there's nothing you can do to make them ready. And you can push and sometimes get people to do stuff that they're not really ready for, but you haven't accomplished anything. People have to know what they're doing. They have to understand it, and they have to want it. And so I try to make that clear to people before I study with them. I said, you know, I just want to show you what's here. And I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to it. But I'm not going to put you in the corner and give you no way out. This has to mean something to you. It has to be your decision. And that's what I want for you. And so if Jesus, who can bend the laws of nature and could bend people if he wanted to, if he doesn't do it, I certainly don't want to do it. Then there's a fifth surprise for these disciples, and I think this one's kind of funny. The fifth surprise, they made it to the other side. Just chapter 5 and verse 1. I mean, it's like those chapter divisions aren't in there in the original version of, Greek version of the Gospel of Mark. But you read right on. They became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Next verse, chapter 5 and verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. There was a time in the middle of this storm when everybody on that boat except Jesus was sure this was it. We're going down, and I hope I have my insurance paid up. And I hope my wife and kids will be okay. But every one of those men on that boat thought all was lost, but lo and behold, wonder of wonders, they came to the other side. Chapter 5 and verse 1. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1 says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And I believe in that God. You believe in that God? Well, that God, in the form of a man, stood on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee with 12 men in a boat one time. And he said, "Let's go over to the other side." Where do you think the boat went? Where can the boat go but to the other side? Because we're dealing with the God of Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. And so when the God of all creation says to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side," there can't be any other way about it. That's where we're going. One way or the other, it may be a crooked path, it may be a bad path, it may be tough, but I guarantee you, at some point, we're at the other side. God will have the last word over our lives. He will write the final chapter of our story. The disciples thought they had come to the end of their story in the middle of that storm. They thought, "Well, this is the last chapter. This is it. There's no more for me." And no one's story is over until God says it's over. Because God will have the last word. Here's the amazing thing. God has written just an amazing ending for our lives. You can turn to the last book, the last chapters there, 21 and 22. Just an amazing ending that he has there for us. I believe it's in 2 Corinthians or 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 6. "Eye has not seen, ear has not heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him." Man, you can't even think it. It's so good. It's a wonderful thing that God, that last chapter he's written for us. And you know what the Lord is saying to all of us today? He said, "Let's go over to the other side. Let's go over together. And if we will get in the boat and stay in the boat, regardless of the storms that come along the way, where do you think that boat and all of us are going to finally end up?" Well, there's no two ways about it. We're going to end up exactly where he is taking that boat, on the other side. You have God's word on it. It's sealed in the blood of his son. He cannot back up on that one. And so, as we come to the end of all of these surprises, just want to remind you of a couple verses. 2 Corinthians 6 and 2 says, "Now is the accepted time. Behold, today is the day of salvation." Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 7 says, "Today, if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts." If you're here today and you've never gotten in the boat, you're being invited to get in the boat. You've never gotten in. Then by all means, today is your day. Do not harden your heart. Now is the accepted time. Today is the day of salvation. And if you're in the boat, then by all means, don't get out. The boat's going to end up where Jesus is taking it. Just stay in the boat. It's all going to be all right. If there's someone here today who needs to respond to the invitation of Christ, we're inviting you to come. We're going to stand and sing a hymn, and if you need to let us know something, to respond, to become a Christian, or to ask for prayers, or say something to the church, just come right to the front and let us know. Let's stand and sing if you need to.